Welcome to episode 228 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. It's wonderful to have you with us, and we are celebrating in the United States of America Memorial Day, and we're going to talk with our good friend and resident historian, Surf William, on today's program, our featured guest, about the history of Memorial Day and what it means, what it should mean, if we're true to its intent. We're going to talk about the unraveling of the Republic regarding some of the policies coming out of Washington, D.C., and the administration of 45. We're going to mention Noam Chomsky, of course, as is the case with Sir William often. We're going to talk about if Donald Trump is a good American, the Rosenbergs a little bit, about thinking, about class struggle, about the narratives handed to people about war and war itself, and a few other things as well. Sir William on today's program. We also have an EW essay by yours truly titled Memorials. We share an excerpt from the brilliant novel by Kurt Vonnegut titled Slaughterhouse-Five, and we have a poem called Corn Cob to share with you too. All of this, as is always the case, is ensconced within several great tunes. Thanks for being with us. Let's get to it. Episode 228 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Shine on all my people who've been broken hearted. Shine on from the place where all life had been started. When you need fresh air, go beyond horizons to your place in the sun. Shine on, let your heart be boundless like your faith in the one. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Tell me that you don't care. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. No stopping of this warfare. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. We're breathing in the same air. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Don't tell me that you don't care. You don't care. No stopping of this warfare. Don't care, no. Sing on from the language of your ancestors and sing on, be playful in your innocence and lift your head up high and rejoice for all you see without your eyes. Sing on like a bird that's making love in sunset skies. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Don't tell me that you don't care. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. No stopping of this warfare. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. We're breathing in the same air. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Don't tell me that you don't care. No life's worth more than any other. No sister worth less than any brother. No life's worth more than any other. No sister worth less than any brother. No life's worth more than any other. No sister worth less than any brother. No life's worth more than any other. No sister worth less than any brother. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Tell me that you don't care. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. No stopping of this warfare. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. We're breathing in the same air. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Don't tell me that you don't care. You don't care. No stopping of this warfare.
don't care. Somebody please send us a prayer.
Memorials. What are memorials? Are they empty rhetorical exercises in self-aggrandizement and cynical manipulation toward control and gain of power? Are they thoughtful, earnest actions tantamount to the achievement of ethical and moral behavior toward a better way of life for the single person, as well as for the greater collective? Do we cherish love and coexistence instead of living to satisfy our basest instincts? Are we strong through our heart, mind, and soul? Or do we have predominant instead our capitalist-driven goals? How is it that we rise each day as does the sun, without taking into consideration all that is part of our existence, simultaneous, all that, our footprints and soul sprints, echoing forever in a moment, and deeply transferring so much, and too, so inconsequential, but for, seemingly, those nearest to our physical ripple effect and unquantifiable gusto, churning personal comfort, support, conflict, confusion, and sometimes glory, sometimes pain, sometimes empty, and sometimes so full of it all to the marrow, life affecting breath of existence in ourselves and each other. Memorials, I think, are but a small semblance or our resemblance to what we hope for and or what we believe others need as we live, how we do, and where we choose to go speaks clearest and most true about who we are.
1, 2, 3, and...
Sound.
There we are. Surf William, okay. Ladies.
But I am here, my brother.
All right. Thank you so much for being on Troubadours and Rock on Tours once again. The art and soul of radio. How do you like that?
I love it. The art and soul?
Yeah. Of radio.
That's going to be the name. Is that going to be the name of your first album, too?
If you like, yeah. You going to play a mandolin on it for me and some fiddle?
Whatever you want.
All right.
Tuba. Sousaphone.
Sousaphone.
Yeah, you name it.
Yeah, he is a man of many talents. He is our resident historian. He is the German teacher.
That's true.
A long-time contributor to the program. It's nice to have you on again, and we're I like to have you on when we have a national holiday because of the fact that you're an historian, and also I like the way you help us put into perspective what it means to be a citizen of the United States of America. So let's get to it, why don't we?
You're raising the bar kind of high for me now. I'm a little nervous.
Oh, come on. Are you naked drinking coffee, as is usually the case when you're on the program?
No, I'm in the bathroom.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I always tell the truth.
I know. Just like Tricky Dick.
Just like Tricky Dick, right. And I'm not a crook.
No,
either.
You're not. You might be a little crooked, but you're not a crook. So.
Well, if you're stealing from the man, I don't have a problem with it. But if you're stealing from, you know, I agree with Robin Hood. But not the reverse Robin Hoods that we see in our society now.
No, we're going to get into that.
Okay, I don't want to get you off track now. I know you have a long list of a long interrogatory for me today, so I'm ready for
it. I do. The first, let's just go right to something that will contextualize maybe our discussion. It is Memorial Day weekend as we speak. Now, this might be listened to a week later or whatever, but I think it'll still be prescient. What is the history of Memorial Day as far as you know it?
Well, it was a holiday. I mean, I'm no expert, but it was a holiday founded after the Civil War to honor the war dead. It's that simple. It was an American holiday to honor the war dead. I think it was actually instituted in the South before it was even instituted in the North. So the Southerners were commemorating the Confederate war dead several years before a group of Union veterans got together and made it a holiday in the North, or decided to just start honoring. I don't know that it wasn't a national holiday. I think they started to just commemorate the war dead.
Just the Civil War?
Well, it started after the Civil War. I'm pretty sure it encompassed all American war dead, but the spirit of it initially was to commemorate the dead in the Civil War. And then after that, it grew out. I don't know the time frame, but obviously over time it grew out to encompass all veterans, you know, all people who had fallen in war, basically.
So it's not just anybody who enlisted in the service necessarily. It's if you fought in war. We memorialize that memory, that part of your sacrifice as a citizen of the United States, as a patriot.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm a novice at this stuff, but when it comes to these holidays, Veterans Day is to commemorate all veterans. Memorial Day is to commemorate those who died, who fell in the service of their country.
Gotcha. So there's the distinction right there. So Veterans Day would be anybody that was in the service. Memorial Day more distinctively for those servicemen and women who had fallen in war time. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And do you think we're true to that I guess intent when we celebrate Memorial Day as of late?
Well, you know, this is the big debate now that's going on. This is the debate that we seem to have in this country. It's really getting heated now with the removal of these Southern memorials to Southern officers. You know, do I think we're true to it? I really do want to answer your question. My feeling is I believe there is a way to honor those who died in war while acknowledging at the same time the values that they were fighting for, and acknowledging whether we can agree that they were positive values that reflect well on our culture, or if in fact they actually, you know, weren't the highest values, but the people who were fighting still gave the ultimate sacrifice. You know that my analysis of history comes from a sort of Marxist angle, and I see war once again as a giant class struggle. There are issues which serve to motivate, which serve to distract, which serve to which serve as rallying cries. But oftentimes, if you really get down into the meat of wars and why they're fought, it's usually over larger economic issues, control of resources, control of wealth, maintaining a certain power structure, which ensures that those in power, those with the wealth, those with the means, those with the resources stay there, and those without stay in their place also. And I see the Civil War as an extension of that. And honestly, most wars you can trace to economic causes. So to get back to your question, I think it's right to honor those who, with all good intentions, chose to fight, volunteered to fight, and then died, while at the same time acknowledging that the value, or the narrative they were told to encourage them to go to war may have been flawed. Does that get to it?
Well, yeah, I think you addressed the question as to whether or not we are true to the intent of this holiday, Memorial Day. Yes, I think you believe that we should honor the fallen in wartime, but at the same time, I think you want us to reflect on whether these folks have fallen for a story that is not in line with our values, and if they were bamboozled, perhaps, and that goes back to the classism of war, as you put it. I think it's an opportunity for us to reflect on what are we telling our young people that we're sending off to die in the name of the United States of America and the values that we say we hold true, we hold close and true. Yeah, I mean, Memorial Day, if it's all of that, it's much better than just blindly waving flags and pumping our biceps saying USA.
Well, that's the easy thing to do, is to wave the flag and say we're number one. Thinking is always more difficult, and thinking is where we run into problems in this country as a culture.
It sounds absurd, you know, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's where we always run into troubles in this country, when we're really forced to think about things. It's easy to wave the flag and say my country right or wrong. It's another thing to really analyze policy and determine the motivations for sending people off to die. I mean, this is a really, really big deal. I think when you look at the Civil War, I think Southern foot soldiers were lied to. They were simply lied to. When you look at World War II, many, many Germans were lied to. They were lied to motivate them for war. You know, Poland never represented an existential threat to Germany. Czechoslovakia never represented an existential threat to Germany. Those countries didn't even do anything that was offensive in any way. You know, the Nazis were able to manipulate the situation to get people to believe that, in fact, these countries represented a threat and had to be stopped. You know, the United States is guilty of this over and over and over again. I've always said, this isn't, when we criticize American foreign policy, it's not anti-American. As a matter of fact, in my opinion, it's an expression of the highest love for your country, because you're able to look at it objectively and say, this isn't healthy, or this behavior is wrong. It's ultimately destructive. And because I love my country so much, and because I don't want to see people on this Memorial Day weekend, because I don't want to see people die for lies, for misguided policy, or for greed, I'm going to examine the reasons we went to war, and I'm going to determine if they were just or not. And oftentimes they're not.
Yeah, you're right. I think that is a higher standard and level of patriotism and love of country. You know, criticizing not just to, you know, it would be often looked at as you're weakening us. You should never criticize us. You're making us look like we were wrong and such. But no, we want to make sure we're doing the right thing. We want to make sure that we're true to the highest principles, ethics, and morals that we have embraced throughout our short history. Some people, though, might not even know what that means at this point. That's the thing that confounds me and concerns me, is some of our fellow citizens don't know what we stand for. They just want to win. They want to be strong. You know, it's adolescent almost. Are they talking about us? Let's kick their asses. Who the hell do they think they are? That's, I mean, you can't let adolescents run the world.
Well, to people like that, I say if what we're talking about seems to be too abstract to them or too troublesome, a simple analogy is sitting around the table at Thanksgiving with your family, and here's your cousin Joe, and Joe's a heroin addict, and everybody knows it. And Joe's sitting at the table, and he looks terrible. He's strung out. He's a mess. Everybody knows he's addicted to drugs. You have a couple of choices. You can ignore him. You can tell him he's great. You're doing great, Joe. Keep it up. Everything you do is perfect. Or you could be honest with him and say, Joe, you have a problem. You need help. So if your country is Joe, then you have to ask yourself, everything my government is doing, everything my country's doing in terms of foreign policy, it's right. It's great. It's super. If you look at that honestly, you're not going to come to that conclusion. Your average person is going to say, wow, there are big problems here. And because you love your country like you love your cousin, you're going to be honest. And you're going to say, I see problems here that have to be addressed. I can't tell you everything's great because everything's not great. And if I were to say it was great, that's the height of dysfunction and enabling.
Yeah. So the United States of America is like a heroin addict, you're saying. Nice. Happy Memorial Day.
Well, our addiction isn't heroin. Our addiction is other things. But
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, we do have a lot of addictions. You know, fossil fuels, electronic devices, ingestion of processed food, all
yes.
kinds of stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Surf William, regular contributor to Troubadours and Rock on Tours, our resident historian, among other things. And he could play the mandolin and pick and grin the banjo, and he's also good with the bow and the violin. One of these days, maybe we'll hear some of his music. Let's get back into our conversation about Memorial Day and related issues. How about the unraveling of the Republic at present? You know, in terms of what the Trump administration is trying to put through Congress in the way of the tax plan he has and the American Health Care Act, a.k.a. Trump Care, and also what's going on with Russia and the collusion, the alleged collusion.
I don't even know where to begin. You know, give me something to start with, because I know you don't have hours, but it would
Trump
take
tax
hours.
Plan. Let's go there first.
Well, the Trump's tax plan is no, I mean, I'm not surprised by that at all. It's a tax plan that we talked about, reverse Robin Hood. He's taking from the poor to give to the rich. I mean, when you look at what Noam Chomsky always says is follow the money. So just look at what's happening with the money. Programs for people in need, programs for the most vulnerable, the most disenfranchised, are being slashed, and the wealthiest people in this country, the really wealthiest corporations and individuals and families, are going to experience massive, massive tax gains from the Trump budget. So I step back and I say, before I even get into all the minutiae, it was obvious from the beginning that this was a giant redistribution of wealth. But I'm willing to wait for the Congressional Budget Office to analyze the budget proposal of the White House.
They did.
And then give their determination on what it will mean in terms of wealth redistribution. And the CBO says very clearly, poor people will experience increases in various expenses, cutting of services that they receive now, while the incredibly wealthy, like the Walton family, are going to see enormous, enormous tax benefits. They're going to be getting back millions, if not billions of dollars for doing nothing at all, simply because of the way that tax code is written. So once again, I see a rich guy working for rich people, even though he's adult, he's still working for rich people. And what's he doing? He's hurting poor people. He's hurting disenfranchised people, minorities, people who live in poverty, and he's benefiting the wealthy. It's a classic reverse Robin Hood economic scheme. And this isn't me, some little, you know, leftist radical saying this. This is the Congressional Budget Office saying this.
And pretty much the same thing with the American Health Care Act that they pushed through the House.
Well, that's a redistribution. Yeah. That, when you look at that at its core, that is another redistribution of wealth. It's a giant tax cut for the wealthy.
Right. Well, cutting Medicare.
And more burdens, and more burden, more economic burden for the worker.
Right. Right. It's really heinous. It's heinous. And people like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and, you know.
Yeah, they work for rich people.
It's amazing. It's blatant.
I mean, here's the thing. This is what I think. I don't think it's shocking that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump are working for rich people at the expense of workers. That doesn't shock me at all. That's what the Republican Party generally does. It's on steroids now, but that's what the Republican Party generally does. What's more shocking and troubling to me are the workers who vote for
like West Virginia. Like West Virginia.
Well, so that's right. Well, the bigger question, the scandal here is not Republicans love rich people and hate the worker. That's not a scandal. That's been common knowledge for 40 years. The scandal here and the confusing part here is all of the workers, the struggling workers who continue to vote for these people. So the bigger question I pose is why? What would make you vote against your own economic self-interest? That one is one that I have to get into deeper. I have my feeling and my opinion about that. I pray to God I'm not right, but I think I am. And I really think what trumps, and I've, excuse the expression, what trumps their economic interest is their fear and their hate. And I hate to say it, but that's how I feel. There's still a massive amount of prejudice in this country, bigotry and racism. There's fear of the other. There's fear of immigration. There's fear of systems that are very big and complex and hard to understand. So people respond to a mental midget like Trump, who puts things in the most basic, ridiculous, idiotic terms. But I hate to say it, for a lot of people, that's familiar. And they can understand that. Mexicans bad, Americans good. Keep them out, build a wall. What a simple message. What a simple, simple message for people to Google. Now, it's completely flawed and wrong, but it's a simple message that people can rally around. And they did, even though they were hurting themselves. That's the more troubling thing. And the hate that came out of this campaign, which was repulsive to people like you and people like me, the hate that came out of this campaign was actually appealing to those people. They voted for him. So that, to me, is the more troubling thing. What is going on with our fellow Americans if they could vote for this person?
Well, I think you're right about the fear and the hate. And I also think it's something that you mentioned earlier in our conversation. It's we don't like to think, and we don't know how to think generally. So a lot of folks, as you alluded to, when things are big and complicated, they're not trained and they're not comfortable to embrace and analyze thoroughly what the situation is. And they're more apt to look at those cliches, the rhetoric, the hyperbole, the one-liners that make them feel comfortable and make them feel focused.
Of course.
That's
well,
the problem,
you know,
too, thinking.
You know, we could go in a lot of directions here. We could talk about political rhetoric and what's a good bumper sticker and what people chant at campaign rallies. Or we can talk about policy and the effects of policy and examining historically what different economic policies have done and coming to some logical conclusions based on the results of similar policies in the past. And if you look at Trump's budget proposal, you will see that it increases the deficit. It redistributes wealth. It hurts productivity. It hurts the worker. It benefits the investor and the already wealthy. Now, am I shocked that Donald Trump would advocate a policy that helps wealthy people and hurts workers? He's been doing that his whole life in his business dealings. Why would anybody be surprised now? And I will say this, and again, I have to watch what I say here because I don't want to see people suffer. But maybe there's a certain amount of suffering that has to happen before people wake up.
I don't know. I think some suffering went on during the W regime, George W. Bush, and no one learned from that. It seemed the fear and the hate of the other, given we had a black man as president, trumped literally the policies and the philosophy to redistribute wealth more equitably, and put together programs that would help more of our citizens. The fact that this black man was in charge freaked people out. Let's get it back to where it's supposed to be.
Well,
the white guy should be in charge.
When you read when you see the to this day, still he's been out of office now for several months. When you see the visceral reaction to Obama from the right, you have to ask yourself, you know, and here's the thing that's always absent in these critiques. I don't hear policy criticism.
No.
I don't hear people saying, I hate Obama because of the policies that he promoted, such as ... various policies. You don't hear that. They attack his wife. They use racist terms. They attack him. They use racism. They use personal attacks on him. And the level of vitriol is really quite shocking. And I have to ask myself, are these people who've analyzed the policy and based on their in-depth analysis of his policies that he advocated, they felt he was really, really bad for America? Or are these people that hate a black man and were simply apoplectic at the thought of a black first family? And I'm sorry, but everything I see leads me to the latter conclusion. These people were freaked out and angry that a black man was in the White House, even though, here's the ironic part, even though his politics were not some radical leftist politics.
No, everything continued. He's a moderate.
Everything continued more or less as it had under previous Democratic and Republican administrations. There was nothing radically different about Obama's policies. Look, the stock market kept going up. The rich kept getting richer. The workers' wages remained stagnant. Jobs continued to go away from America. That's a condemnation of capitalism. That's a whole other discussion we could get into. So nothing radically changed under Obama. His rhetoric was a little bit softer, and lefties like you and me, we liked him. We thought he's a charming guy. I'd like to go have a beer with him. But all that aside, policy didn't radically change under Obama. I didn't think it would, and it didn't. So where does all the hate come from? Well, I'm led to only one conclusion. He's a black man, and he's hated because of that. The hate for Bill Clinton was not as strong as the hate for Barack Obama, and their policies were similar.
And, you know, you and I relate to a black man because we were born poor black children.
I was.
A.K.A. Steve Martin.
That's right.
And what was the name of that movie? The Jerk. Right. Two jerks here on... Right.
Now we're showing our age. Now you're giving our ages away.
Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum and Surf Williams.
What's next, E.W.? A Cheech and Chong reference?
Maybe. So let's go into something else. Donald Trump, then, is he a good American? And what I mean by that...
No, he's a horrible... No, I'll answer that question. You don't even have to qualify that. No. He's a traitor. He's a horrible American. He should be brought up on treason charges. He should meet the same fate as maybe the Rosenbergs. What do you think of that?
Whoa, the Rosenbergs. You mean Ethel and Julius?
Yes.
Yeah, isn't it the anniversary right around now when they were executed for treason? I think.
I don't know what the anniversary was. I feel it's based on everything that they were guilty. They were guilty of what they were charged. But once again, in America, the problem is their trial was deeply, deeply flawed. Deeply, deeply flawed. Because what you get in America is we almost can't control our instinct to hate and to kill. So the Rosenbergs were put on trial in a horribly flawed trial, found guilty. In fact, most historians have decided, yeah, it looks like they were guilty. That's from what everyone can tell. It looks like they were guilty. And so there you go. The government has a case against them that it could easily win. But it still has to rig the judicial system just to make sure.
And they were guilty of treason with the Russians, collusion with the Soviet Union. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. They actually gave away a lot of secrets. Yeah.
They were executed on June 19th of 1953. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Espionage with the Soviet Union was the charge. So you believe a president, though, we don't necessarily, we've never executed a president for anything. That would be a stretch.
That'd be a first.
So what you're saying now is going to make people freaked out. If anybody's listening to this, these guys are advocating...
I'm advocating due process for everyone in this country, including the president. That's not some radical concept. I'm saying based on where I stand, and granted, I'm just some peon far, far away from the action. But based on where I stand, there's so much smoke. I would find it shocking if there wasn't some fire. The behavior of this president, simply his behavior alone, in my opinion, is enough of a reason for Congress to think about impeachment. I understand the implications of that. I understand how that can be abused. But what's happening now domestically and on the world stage is not only embarrassing, it's a little bit frightening.
It is frightening. You know, I mean, it's embarrassing for sure, but it's definitely frightening. And that's the more important part here. You know, if there is espionage and you go to his son-in-law, Jared Kushner's name has been thrown around a lot now as somebody who perhaps, you know. So, I mean, there's that's not the president. And I have to tell you, and I don't know if this is a classism, I really have a deep-seated problem with people being handed, young especially, relatively speaking, 35-year-old guy or whatever, being handed all of this power on a world stage just because he's the son-in-law of the president. That to me seems so un-American. It angers me. And then there's a level of arrogance and entitlement and smugness that this guy walks around now trying to and making money for himself and his and the Trump family and the Kushner family in the process off of on our dime. It really, really angers me. This is un-American. And if he's found to have colluded with the Russians, I think he should go to prison at least.
Of course. Absolutely.
But he won't.
There are laws against
But he
that.
Won't.
There are laws against
He will
that.
Not, though. He will.
Well, don't forget, everybody can be pardoned. And once you're pardoned, that's it. You walk away. So I personally think if there's any logic going on inside that brain, that pea brain of Trump's, it's that I don't care what happens, I'm going to be pardoned. Because if Pence takes over, Pence will certainly pardon him and everybody else around him. That's the president's prerogative.
Shame. It's the shame factor, too. They don't want to be shamed, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if these people have any shame. When I see Trump and his family, I don't see any shame there. I don't think they operate with the same shame limitations as you.
But if they get impeached, if he gets impeached, don't you think he'll be shamed then?
These are shameless. I don't know. That's all speculation, and it's almost beside the point. The bottom line is, Trump cares about Trump. That's it. And if he gets impeached, which by the way is a long, 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 long way away, but if he gets impeached, I think he will continue to rant and rave, and he will do what he can to undermine the political social fabric of our society, like he's been doing since he's come on the stage. Everything he has done has been to the detriment of a unified America. He's done everything he can to divide us. Everything he's done has been to hurt this country. I've never, ever, ever. No one's ever seen a president like this. The standard line when you win the election is, we are all Americans. We shall not put the election behind us. We will come together. Yeah, it's BS. I get that. But it's a line. And you expect to hear the president say that. That's what you expect from your leader. This is the first president in the history of America. That's not hyperbole. That's a fact. Who, upon winning the election, continued to attack not only his political opponent, who he defeated, but all the people who supported him.
And
that's a first in American history.
And that is a significant point to make. And even when you go to the international stage, he's been on this European tour, Middle Eastern European tour, and NATO, he's berating our NATO allies, saying you need to pay up. We're not going to foot the bill anymore. They're all shocked that he would talk to them that way. He doesn't know. He's really about power and posturing. He's an adolescent. And I want to kind of wrap some things together here. We're getting to the end of our conversation. You're responding right now to, is Donald Trump a good American citizen? And you're saying no. And we're talking about his family, too. They're not good Americans. They're taking advantage. But maybe they are good Americans. If you look at Americans as being greedy, you know, that stereotype of us. And some people look at us as being greedy. And we're a capitalistic society. We're, you know, survival of the fittest. And if you can get it before someone else gets it. And in that regard, they maybe are good Americans. But I like to think that that's not what a good American is. You know, a good American is someone who has, an ethical, moral compass that includes a sense of egalitarianism and, equitable sort of opportunity for everyone, not just those that are connected or those that step on other people to move up the socioeconomic ladder. So I wanted to put all that into perspective. And then Memorial Day, the blood. We talk about people, our fellow citizens, falling in wartime and how often they are bamboozled. And nonetheless, they're still heroes because they go and they say, I'm going to believe in this. You need me. I'm going to go. And other people don't even have a choice. They're drafted and they're sent. If they don't go, they're going to get jailed. And either way, they die in the line of what we call duty. That blood is okay to spill. And we wave a flag and we have some parades once a year, twice a year. in the honor of their blood being spilt. But then someone who does, like, if it's true, collude with our enemies at the expense in so many ways, economically and just in terms of physical health and well-being, changes policy, their blood will never spill. They'll always get pardoned. They'll always continue keeping their higher level of status in society. And I don't want anybody's blood to spill. I don't, you know, that's not the way of it. But I have to ask myself, you know, why is it, and, you know, it's a naive, asinine question, I know. Why is it that the poor folk or the middle class folk, their blood has to be spilt in the name of honor, in the name of the progress, in the name of protection? But those who are going the opposite direction, unhonorable, not protecting our well-being, they're always safe.
EW, I am so proud of you. You finally fully embraced Marxism, and I applaud you. And finally, after all these years of your study and your reading and your research, you finally figured it out. It's about time, EW. You are echoing the ideas of Karl Marx, wherein he framed everything in terms of class struggle. The poor will always pay the price. The wealthy very rarely do. That is the dynamic of capitalist society. And Trump, in effect, on his campaign, as we and I talked about previously, he was actually condemning capitalism when he said all these jobs are going overseas and that's wrong. Capitalism is, at its core, unjust and unequal. People don't like to hear that because we seem to, you know, we seem, along with pledging allegiance to the flag, we seem to pledge allegiance to capitalism. But in fact, everything you just said is an indication of the problems with capitalism and the unjust nature of capitalism, where the wealthy continue to reap all the benefit and the worker continues to do all the work. And that's simply the way it is. So will Trump be punished? Probably not. Will Jared Kushner go to jail? Almost certainly not. There are already measures in place to protect people like them. Every now and then you get a sacrificial lamb like Bernie Madoff. Who cares about Bernie Madoff, right? He committed some sort of Ponzi scheme, right? He's a rich guy. Yeah, so every now and then you get a DeLorean or a Madoff, and they hold them up and they say, see, the system works. Meanwhile, there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of other people who are exploiting the work and gaming the system like Trump did in his tax returns, and they don't ever get punished, and the system works. The system makes sure that they can continue to do what they do on the backs of the worker. That's my historical perspective on it. From all my research, that's what I see, and this goes back to ancient times.
Surf William, thank you so much. Happy Memorial Day. It was wonderful talking.
Oh, I'm not done. I'm just getting started. I need another, like, at least another
hour. We're going to have you on again. You're a regular contributor to Troubadours and Rock On Tours.
Okay.
You're on staff.
Good. The check's in the mail.
Thank you so much. Awesome. Hopefully I see you soon.
Happy Memorial Day.
You too, brother.
All
Ciao.
Right. Ciao.
Trumpet man from out Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot dilly out a toot. He blows it 8 to the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes the company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. And when he plays boogie woogie bugle, he was busy as a buzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump way to the bar. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Toot 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 da da toot da da toot toot. He blows it 8 to the bar. He can't blow a note if the bass and guitar isn't with him. The company jumps when he plays reveille. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Every night, and wakes them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet, because they know how he plays. When someone gives him a beat, he really breaks it up. When he plays reveille, he's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Da 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 da.
An excerpt from Kurt Vonnegut's masterpiece, Slaughterhouse-Five. All this happened, more or less. The war parts, anyway, are pretty much true. One guy I knew really was shot in Dresden for taking a teapot that wasn't his. Another guy I knew really did threaten to have his personal enemies killed by hired gunmen after the war, and so on. I've changed all the names. I really did go back to Dresden with Guggenheim money, God love it, in 1967. It looked a lot like the Dayton, Ohio, more open spaces than Dayton has. There must be tons of human bone meal in the ground. I went back there with an old war buddy, Bernard V. O'Hare, and we made friends with a cab driver who took us to the slaughterhouse where we had been locked up at night as prisoners of war. His name was Gerhard Mueller. He told us that he was a prisoner of the Americans for a while. We asked him how it was to live under communism, and he said that it was terrible at first because everybody had to work so hard and because there wasn't much shelter or food or clothing. But things were much better now. He had a pleasant little apartment, and his daughter was getting a good education. His mother was incinerated in the Dresden firestorm. So it goes. He sent O'Hare a postcard at Christmas time, and here's what it said. I wish you and your family, also as to your friend, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and I hope that we'll meet again in a world of peace and freedom in the taxi cab, if the accident will. I like that very much. If the accident will. I would hate to tell you what this lousy little book cost me in money and anxiety and time. When I got home from the Second World War 23 years ago, I thought it would be easy for me to write about the destruction of Dresden, since all I would have to do would be to report what I had seen. And I thought, too, that it would be a masterpiece, or at least make me a lot of money, since the subject was so big. But not many words about Dresden came from my mind then, not enough of them to make a book, anyway. And not many words come now, either, when I have become an old fart with his memories and his Pall Malls, with his sons full grown. I think of how useless the Dresden part of my memory has been, and yet how tempting Dresden has been to write about. And I am reminded of the famous limerick. There was a young man from Stamboul who soliloquized thus to his tool. You took all my wealth, and you ruined my health, and now you won't pee, you old fool. And I'm reminded, too, of the song that goes, my name is Jan Janssen. I work in Wisconsin. I work in a lumber mill there. The people I meet when I walk down the street, they say, what is your name? And I say, my name is Jan Janssen. I work in Wisconsin. And so on to infinity. Over the years, people I've met have often asked me what I'm working on, and I've usually replied that the main thing was a book about Dresden. I said that to Harrison Starr, the movie maker, one time, and he raised his eyebrows and inquired, is it an anti-war book? Yes, I said, I guess. You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? No, what do you say, Harrison Starr? I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead? What he meant, of course, was that there would always be wars, that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that, too. And even if wars didn't keep coming like glaciers, there would still be plain old death. When I was somewhat younger, working on my famous Dresden book, I asked an old war buddy named Bernard V. O'Hare if I could come to see him. He was a district attorney in Pennsylvania. I was a writer on Cape Cod. We had been privates in the war, infantry scouts. We had never expected to make any money after the war, but we were doing quite well. I had the Bell Telephone Company find him for me. They are wonderful that way. I have this disease late at night sometimes involving alcohol and the telephone. I get drunk and I drive my wife away with a breath like mustard gas and roses. And then, speaking gravelly and elegantly into the telephone, I ask the telephone operators to connect me with this friend or that one, from whom I have not heard in years. I got O'Hare on the line in this way. He is short, I am tall. We were Mutt and Jeff in the war. We were captured together in the war. I told him who I was on the telephone. He had no trouble believing it. He was up. He was reading. Everybody else in his house was asleep. "Listen," I said, "I'm writing this book about Dresden. I'd like some help remembering stuff. I wonder if I could come down and see you, and we could drink and talk and remember." He was unenthusiastic. He said he couldn't remember much. He told me, though, to come ahead. "I think the climax of the book will be the execution of poor old Edgar Derby," I said. "The irony is so great. A whole city gets burned down, and thousands of people are killed, and then this one American foot soldier is arrested in the ruins for taking a teapot, and he's given a regular trial, and then he's shot by a firing squad." "Hmm," said O'Hare. "Don't you think that's really where the climax should come?" "I don't know anything about it," he said. "That's your trade, not mine." We'll be right back. corn cob. The corn cob sweet kernels with butter and salt in between these teeth, touching the lips and causing my taste buds through the accompaniment of birdsong, me to feel amidst the summer warm breeze. I thank you, the trees.
Over the horizon, she's smooth sailing these concrete seas. Now she headed east down the boulevard. Sure, said I like the way, said I like the way. You sail your ship now, let me be your cargo. I won't wear you down, no honey, I won't wear you down. A destination, but I got a feeling I need to be your passenger. She can let me be your passenger. Sure, said I like the way, said I like the way. You sail your ship now, let me be your cargo. I won't weigh you down, no honey, I won't weigh you down. Smooth sailing, darling. Sweet pretty baby, won't you be my lady? Sweet honey, darling, you know I'm calling. I want you. For sure, said I like the way, said I like the way. Sail your ship now, let me be your cargo. I won't weigh you down, no honey, I won't weigh you down. So smooth sailing. Darling. Sweet pretty baby, won't you be my lady? Sweet honey darling, you know I'm calling. I want you. Sure, said I like the way, said I like the way. Sail your ship now, let me be your cargo. I won't weigh you down, no honey, I won't weigh you down.
And there you have it, episode 228 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, our regular contributor and good friend, resident historian, William the Surf. Surf William, so much fun talking with you this week. I also like to thank Kurt Vonnegut for writing Slaughterhouse 5 and for experiencing what you did and sharing it so eloquently and so powerfully with the rest of your citizens here in the United States and beyond. I'd like to thank also these musical artists: Michael Fronte and Spearhead, White Stripes, the Andrew Sisters, Soundgarden, Leon Bridges, Brentford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. Have a wonderful week. Until next time, toodaloo.